Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Hurricane Irma is now a Category 4 storm and has slammed ashore at Key West, Florida, early Sunday with whirling winds and pounding rain, leaving behind a trail of destruction across fragile Caribbean islands. And VOA reporter Tobias Hassell has been hunkered down in a Miami hotel and says although the brunt of the storm isn't expected there until late this evening, he's already seeing and feeling its effects. Outside his window, he says there's debris everywhere and even a traffic signal on the ground. Crossing the Caribbean, Irma left at least 25 people dead and catastrophic destruction everywhere. Among the islands hardest hit was Barbuda, which was virtually flattened. And one woman in neighboring Antigua, arriving back in London, talked about the destruction there. Back in Florida, where nearly 7 million people were asked to evacuate ahead of Hurricane Irma's landfall, the highest sustained winds are now about 210 kilometers per hour. The death toll from the massive earthquake that struck Mexico Thursday night has risen to at least 90 after emergency services in the southern state of Oaxaca said late on Saturday there had been 71 confirmed fatalities in that state alone. At least 15 people died in neighboring state of Chiapas. That's according to local authorities, while another four deaths have been blamed on confirmed in Tabasco in the north. The 8.1 magnitude quake that struck off the coast of Chiapas on Thursday was stronger than a devastating 1985 trembler that flattened swaths of Mexico City and killed thousands of people there. This is VOA News. Rohingya insurgents in Myanmar have called for a month-long ceasefire starting this Sunday in order to allow humanitarian aid there. The violence has left at least 400 people dead and thousands of Rohingya have left to Bangladesh. At least three people were killed and 13 others wounded after a suicide bomber blew himself up at a tea shop in the central Somali town, the police and witnesses say. Three journalists are among the wounded, and witnesses told VOA Somali that the explosion was loud and shook the area. Nancy Hatch Dupree, a prolific American expert on the history of art and archaeology of Afghanistan, has died at the age of 90 after battling an illness in a Kabul hospital. Dupree arrived in the country in 1962 as a diplomat's wife and dedicated the rest of her life to collecting and preserving the war-shattered country's cultural heritage. In 2013, she founded and opened the Afghanistan Center at Kabul University, the first facility of its kind in the country dedicated to the study of Afghanistan's history, culture, and society. The late historian was the director of the center until recently. In several VOA interviews over the years, she said that Aku was inspired by the work and vision of Louise Dupree, renowned archaeologist and scholar. The head of the United Nations peacekeeping forces says that rising ethnic tensions in Central African Republic are likely to spur greater conflict between the Muslim and Christian communities unless action is taken to defuse the situation.
The hurricane itself was like being in a nightmare. And
UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations Jean-Pierre Lacroix says ethnic hate speech is running in parallel with an increase in violence in Central African Republic. Lacroix says it is a key responsibility of the leadership and all those who have an influence in Central African Republic to counter those messages. War between the Muslim Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka armed groups broke out in 2013 after Seleka rebels toppled the Christian president François Bozizé. Peacekeeping Chief Lacroix tells VOA every effort is being made to redeploy UN forces on the ground to try to mitigate the impact of this violence and to protect civilians. The United Nations is trying to reconcile the two ethnic communities by working with religious, civic, and political leaders from different walks of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It does not make political sense. It does not make practical sense. For starters, the voter registration kits are not yet in the country. We only have 400 voter registration kits out of 3,000 voter registration kits.
President Robert Mugabe says the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission will begin voter registration this week ahead of next year's general election.
They've just released a statement and they say, of course, they were congratulating the Angolan people for the way they participated in the electoral process.
The newly elected Angolan President João Lourenço has called for dialogue with opposition political parties.
Steve Green began to start a collection of biblical antiquities, and he became passionate about it. And so he would buy antiquities when he could. And then he decided it's not good to have them just in a warehouse.
And the Museum of the Bible, the first museum totally dedicated to the Bible, will soon open its doors to the public. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says the country will begin a voter registration process this week to compile a list to be used for the 2018 presidential and parliamentary elections. He says the Electoral Commission will start registering prospective voters on September 14 and will end the process on January 15 next year. But opponents, including the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, has rejected President Mugabe's statement. To learn more about the party's opposition to the voter registration dates, I reached Douglas Wanzora, Secretary General for the Movement for Democratic Change in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
It does not make political sense. It does not make practical sense. For starters, the voter registration kits are not yet in the country. We only have 400 voter registration kits out of 3,000 voter registration kits. And the 400 which came are only for purposes of training. They are not enough to start voter registration. Number two, we agreed with the Election Commission together with other political parties that we must agree on the voter registration centers. That exercise is not complete yet. So Mr. Mugabe has given a date for voter registration without the voter registration centers. Further, there is an exercise here where people are getting new identity cards, those who don't have them. That program started on Monday, and it is supposed to end somewhere in November. So there is no basis for proclaiming voter registration next week.
Why do you think he is pressing so hard to have the elections done quickly?
He will be less fit come 22 July than he will be, say, in March. That's where it is rumored that he wants to have an election. But the constitution of Zimbabwe doesn't allow him for an election anymore. He has to call an election on the last day of the presidential term, which is defined as the last month of the presidential term, which is 5 years after the swearing in of the president. He was sworn in on the 27th of August 2018.
Since President Mugabe made this announcement, has your party, together with other opposition parties, registered your protest to the Independent Electoral Commission?
Yes, we have already got in touch with the Independent Electoral Commission, and the Independent Electoral Commission is in agreement with us that it is not possible to start voter registration on the 14th of September. It is in agreement. But whether they will be able to stand up to Mugabe is the true test of their independence. It does not make sense. It will not happen. It will not be possible to start voter registration under the biometric voter registration system. And President Mugabe now wants to change the voter registration system to the usual system that was there, which is not biometric.
Are the opposition parties, including your MDC led by Tsvangirai, satisfied with the fact that for the first time the Electoral Commission has decided to deploy the biometric system of registering and voting during the elections?
Yes, because the biometric voter registration system didn't come from the Zimbabwe Election Commission. It came from the MDC. It has been our demand since 2005, and we were fighting for it all this time. The fact that they then have it means that they relented, and we are happy about that. So we are happy that there is a biometric voter registration system.
With your interaction so far with the Independent Electoral Commission, how satisfied are you with its independence ahead of the voter registration exercise, if indeed it goes ahead as President Mugabe has announced?
The Zimbabwe Election Commission is not independent. Institutionally, it is made up of the Secretariat, which includes people from the army, from the intelligence, and from the police. In other words, from the security service. This is what we have been arguing against the Zimbabwe Election Commission, because the main problem of Zimbabwe is the militarization of the electoral process. So to the extent that it is made up of people from the military, we are not happy about its independence.
Douglas Mwanzora is the Secretary General for the Zimbabwean Main Opposition Party, the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC. He spoke with me from Harare. The Angolan president-elect João Lourenço has called for dialogue with the opposition parties. He made the appeal after the confirmation of the ruling party, the People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA, was declared winner of the August 23rd general election. Last week, the Angolan National Electoral Commission confirmed that the MPLA had won the poll with 61.07% vote. But citing irregularities, leaders of the four largest opposition parties said they want a new count at the provincial level after rejecting the results as rigged. For analysis, I reach political commentator and women's rights activist Silzatina Kutaya in the Angolan capital, Luanda.
The statement from the opposition, they've just released a statement, and they say, of course, they were congratulating the Angolan people for the way they participated in the electoral process. But they end the statement by saying that, number one, they are going to appeal to the Constitutional Court on the deliberations of the Electoral Commission. And then number two, that they are not going to legitimize the institutions that resulted from these elections if there is no remedies to what happened. And you know that they've been claiming that the Electoral Commission failed to observe the law in the process of tabulating the results at the provincial level and at national level. So it's very confusing because there's statements that are being made to the media, but there hasn't been any actual effort for the political parties to actually sit down and have a conversation and engage in a positive dialogue.
Do you think the opposition sees the president's call for dialogue as genuine after he criticized them for what he called their misbehavior during the election process?
I do not. Actually, I was astonished by the speech that the president, the indicated elected president, was making following the announcement from the Electoral Commission, because it seems like it was a campaign speech. It was a speech that showed complete disrespect and disregard for the political parties, for the opposition parties that were running in this election. And for him to come out now and say that he wanted to dialogue, it's a bit controversial. It sounds very disingenuous.
Leaders of the four largest opposition parties want to hold a new count at the provincial level after rejecting the results announced by the Electoral Commission. What has been the response of the Electoral Commission, and has the Electoral Commission officials made any effort to resolve their concerns?
No. The Electoral Commission has considered those suggestions to have no ground. They don't have any legal ground. And right now, the only way is the appeal to the Constitutional Court, because the Electoral Commission is intransigent. They have not considered any of the claims from the opposition parties. None of all four opposition parties and the coalition. They disregarded all of the complaints they put forward the commission. Right now, the hope is that the Constitutional Court really looks at it and really applies the rule of law in this matter. But the problem is, a week after the elections, there was a private newspaper that published a survey that they did, and they were inquiring how people felt about public institutions. And the general sentiment of the Angolan people is that public institutions are not credible. They are not trusted because they don't function observing the rule of law. Most of those institutions are party influenced. They are constantly ruling and acting in favor of the ruling party.
Looking at what you have just said about the Constitutional Court, what are the prospects of the opposition receiving favorable ruling from the court, since it appears that the MPLA could get away with it by the blessing of the Constitutional Court, even if the legitimacy of the Constitutional Court is being questioned?
I think the prospects of the opposition having a favorable ruling on this matter are very narrow, very limited. I don't know if it would help if other institutions from the country, say the religious leaders, say people from civil society organizations, if they make statements, perhaps that could help. I don't know. But if we depend solely on the deliberations of the Constitutional Court, it's very unlikely that they are going to be to rule in favor of the opposition's claims.
Cizaltina Kutaya is an Angolan political commentator and women's rights activist. She spoke with me from Luanda. Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, boasts of high-quality museums and pride as the city that has the highest number of museums in the United States. In the fall, Washington will increase its wealth of museums and attractions when the Museum of the Bible, the first museum totally dedicated to the Bible, will open its doors to the public. Grace Alheri Abdu from VOA's Hausa Service spoke with Dr. Paul Anthony Zees, Executive Director for the Museum of the Bible.
Steve Green began to start a collection of biblical antiquities, and he became passionate about it. And so he would buy antiquities when he could. And then he decided it's not good to have them just in a warehouse. So let's start some traveling exhibits. So they went all over the U.S., and then they went to Israel. Then they went to the Vatican two times. Mm-hmm. They even went to Cuba, and they were a huge success. So then he said, if this is so good, why don't we develop the world's first world-class museum to the Bible? Mm-hmm. And so they surveyed three cities, New York City, mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., and Dallas. And all of the survey results said Washington, D.C. is the museum capital of the U.S. Mm. Go to Washington, D.C.
Oh, I see. What's the purpose?
The purpose is to engage people with the Bible, its history, its narrative, stories, and its impact. No other book has had such an impact on civilization, particularly Western civilization. We do not advocate any one religion. We don't advocate any doctrine. We just present the book, and people can make up their own minds. And we present the book in an educational way and in an entertaining way. And so we try to give people a really wonderful experience. When they leave this museum, we want them to say, that's the best museum experience I have ever had.
How do you come about collecting what you will put in the museum, for instance?
Well, they usually work with antiquities dealers, and they have to be certified, and then they have to prove the history of the antiquities, and then they negotiate a price for the antiquities. So that's where the collection came from for Mr. Green. He has since given about 2,500 pieces of his collection to this museum. And we don't... As I mentioned, we don't work specifically with anyone. We have the Jewish Bible. Mm-hmm. We have sometimes we call the New Testament or the Protestant Bible. We have the Catholic Bible. So we look at all Bibles, and we look at artifacts and Bibles that were translated and written way back. We have, we have Psalms 19, the oldest copy of Psalms 19, and I think we have just part of it, mm-hmm. and it was in Greek, and it was in papyrus. Mm-hmm. So whatever we can get, we get, and then we have scholars who look at it and curators who look at it, and they translate it, and then they add that to the Bible's history. Mm-hmm. So they add to the body of knowledge. So this is a working museum as well as an entertaining and an educational museum.
Are you going to meet the financial need of the museum if you are not going to charge gate fee
when
people come?
You bring up a good point. We're in the process right now of hiring 170 people mm-hmm. In various areas to operate the museum. But we will hire two times that many, maybe three times that many, mm-hmm. as volunteers who volunteer and want to work in the museum. Mm-hmm. And so they will help us. We couldn't do it all on our own. They will help us direct people. Some will be docents, so they will know a lot about, we'll train them on an exhibit, and they can talk a lot about that exhibit. Others will be guides. They can guide people if they want a special guide to take them through the museum. And we have a digital docent. Mm-hmm. And this one is not a human, but it's a tablet.
Oh.
And so you tell it your name, and then it will ask you questions. What are you most interested in? The history of the Bible, the narrative of the Bible,
oh.
you know, or the impact of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then it will ask how much time you have. And if you have 2 hours or 4 hours, whatever it is, it will develop a route for you. And it will tell you where to go from one exhibit to the next and what floors you go on.
Dr. Paul Anthony Zis is the executive director for the Museum of the Bible. He spoke with Grace Alheri Abdu from VOA's House of Service in Washington. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports about 800,000 people commit suicide every year. To mark this year's World Suicide Prevention Day, which is today, September 10, the WHO is stressing the important role the media can play in stopping people from taking their own lives. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Worldwide, every 40 seconds, someone commits suicide. The World Health Organization reports for every suicide, 20 others, mainly young people, attempt to take their own lives. WHO says suicide is the second leading cause of death among 15 to 29-year-olds. It finds most suicides, more than 78%, occur in low- and middle-income countries, and risk factors include mental disorders, particularly depression and anxiety resulting from alcohol use. WHO cites growing evidence that the media can play a significant role in preventing suicide by reporting responsibly on these tragedies. Scientist in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, Alexandra Fleischman, tells VOA, people are often reluctant to talk about suicide because of the stigma attached. She says journalists can help to overcome this taboo by encouraging people to seek help and to speak openly about their distress.
It is also important to stress that the encouragement to work with the media and not just to talk about the don'ts. Don't put it in the headline. Don't put the picture of the person who died. Don't sensationalize it. Don't glamorize it.
WHO warns irresponsible reporting of this sort often can trigger copycat suicides or increase the risk. The UN Health Agency reports the most common methods of suicide are self-poisoning with pesticides and firearms. It says many of these deaths could be prevented by restricting access to these means. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And a young South Sudanese in the diaspora is collecting books for vulnerable South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. Yumal Day formed a non-profit called South Sudan Reads. She says her goal is to improve literacy rate among South Sudanese children through education outreach activities. She told VOA's South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza that her organization has got some donation from Book Africa, but she has no money to transport the books to refugee camps in Ethiopia.
The work that I do in South Sudan is it come from the heart, I will say, especially when it comes to education. As a child, growing up, I did not have all that opportunities to be able to go to school, to be able to read a books, to be able to do things that child should do, because of the fact that we always on the runs and doing certain things due to the war. So it affected everybody. But when you have an opportunity to be around the world where the education is there for you, why shouldn't you take that opportunities? And that's where I realized that, you know, there are kids that are like, used to be like me back home, do not have the tool of education background. So, and the best way to do that is to spread the love of education that I have here. And what I did was I started a nonprofit organization that will be able to help this type of situations. And the South Sudan Read mission is to educate, development, and construct library internationally. I took out the construction part because in South Sudan, we do not have libraries that are constructed back home, probably only in Juba area. That's where the library are located.
When are you constructing a library in Gambela? Just tell us a little bit about that.
So about 2 months ago, I traveled back home to see what's going on and what is affecting our people. So I did went all the way to the refugees camp in Tarpam, and then also all the way to Pagak area. And I observe and I look at it. And the situation, it's very unfortunately devastated as we speak.
Describe a school in one of the refugee camps that you went to. Describe how a classroom looks like.
Oh, my God. So some of the classroom that I saw, they literally, the classroom are pretty much are built with muds and hut house pretty much. They don't have like chairs where like children can be able to sit and be able to educate themselves. Some of them write on the sand or however you want to call it. So they will write ABC on the grounds and be able to educate themselves like that. And then some area where is in Gambela region that is affected too by the refugees, within the one classroom, it can go up to 150 children where there is not even like resources. The classroom, the chair that they're sitting in, they're broken. It just devastated at some point, you know, even myself, I feel bad because I look at it, you know, I'm not doing enough.
But talk about the books that you have taken so far and distributed. How many books have you distributed so far?
So when I travel back to Ethiopia or toward the refugees area, I took about 7 backpacks. Some of those backpacks, 7 backpacks of luggage, almost like 400 books and 400 backpacks. Majority of those with pen and pencil and certain things like that. I pretty much did all the resources by myself and with the other community involvement too as well. As of right now, Book of Africa is willing to donate me 22,000 books that I can distribute it to them. Like I said, you know, because of the lack of resources, I can't really do much right now.
So you're telling me Book of Africa, where are they based?
Book of Africa are based in Minnesota.
So they are willing to give you more books to take to South Sudan.
Correct.
But you don't know how to take it. I mean, you don't have the resources for transporting it.
I don't have the resources for transporting
it. Have you spoken to people who could help with that?
That's what I'm looking for, and I hope that somebody out there can be able to help out more.
And so how much would it cost to take a book from Minnesota to Gambela?
So far, from what I'm what I observed so far, what I have researched is about $15,000 for the whole thing. And that's what the Book of Africa said, too.
If someone would like to reach you, to you, how do they go about?
Well, if somebody wants to reach out to us, they can definitely go to our website. It's www.ssread.org. Or they can email us to southsudanread@gmail.com. And then also, too, they can reach us on our Facebook page. So there's so many ways that you can reach us.
And so have you made your case known to people that you are here, out here, collecting books, and you would like to take them to South Sudan, and here you're stuck? Have you made your case known?
Yes, I have made my case known. And due to the fact that, you know, I'm working too on the side, it's kind of make it difficult for me to just focus on one thing. So, but I know that for a fact, I am dedicated to this work and it will be done.
Nyimalde is the executive director and the founder of a nonprofit called South Sudan Reads. She spoke with VOA South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza from Washington. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with athletics. Britain's Mo Farah claimed a record fourth successive victory in the 37th Great North Run. The 34-year-old overcame New Zealand's Jake Robertson in the thrilling duel to win in 1 hour 6 seconds. London Marathon winner Mary Kaitani of Kenya surged to her third victory in the women's race in 1 hour, 5 minutes and 59 seconds. Meanwhile, Jocelyn Jepkosgei broke the world 10-kilometer record at the Berea Prague Grand Prix, an IAAF gold label road race on Saturday. The 23-year-old Kenyan clocked 29.43, smash through the 30-minute barrier and break her own record of 30.04, also set in the Czech capital at the Sportsimo Prague Half Marathon on April 1st. The performance marked the fifth world record of the year for Jepkosgei, who broke 4, 10 kilometers, 15 kilometers, 20 kilometers, and the half marathon en route her victory at the Prague Half Marathon. Behind her compatriot Efanse Chemtai was second in 30.06, just 2 seconds outside of the previous world record for the third fastest time ever. Viola Chepchumba, last year's winner, clocked 30.25 to finish a third. The men's race also delivered some especially fast times, with the first three producing the three fastest times in the world this season. It was a thriller as well, with Bernard Kemeli and Matthew Kemeli battling stride for stride over the final kilometer before Bernard prevailed in 27.10, a new course record and lifetime best. Matthew Kemeli crossed the finish line just a step behind in 27.11, with little-known compatriot Ronex Kipruto third in 27.13. Eight men managed to finish in under 28 minutes, including the Norwegian Sondre Moen, whose performance of 27.55 meant a personal best and the best time recorded this year. And in African football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, will begin an inspection visit to Kenya on Monday ahead of next year's African Nations Championships, CHAN. Originally, the trip had been due to begin on September 7th, but was postponed due to uncertainty following the annulled presidential elections in Kenya. The delegation led by DR Congo's CAF second vice president, Constant Omari Suleiman, will spend 8 days in Kenya for what is the third and final inspection visit. Kenya is scheduled to host the tournament for locally best players only between January 12th and February 4th, 2018. Rwanda hosted the last edition of the African Nations Championship in February 2016, which was won by the DR Congo. And finally, in tennis, unseeded Sloane Stephens completed a spectacular return from injury by beating fellow American Madison Keys to win the U.S. Open. Stephens, ranked 83rd, beat 15th seed Keys 6-3, 6-0 in the final. The 24-year-old was ranked as low as number 957 6 weeks ago, having only returned from 11 months out with a foot injury at Wimbledon. She becomes only the fifth unseeded woman to win a major title in the Open era. The first American woman from outside the Williams family to win a major singles title since Jennifer Capriati at the 2002 Australian Open, Stephens collected almost $3 million in prize money. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Girl, I'm drowning in your love. Yeah. So baby, take it all. I know with you no turning back. Oh. Girl, I said it all. I don't care what people say about you. Don't care if they must spoil you from you. Because I told you before that I wanna go far with you. That's enough, it mess up too. Hassam in my boo. Show my true friend, you my love. Oh, no, go to Roma, no. Go to Boba, check, go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. This is for real. No go grief another man bore you out, baby. No go jump another woman no out. Feeling I'm feeling for you, baby, is awakening my soul. I will love you till nobody I see what you they won't do for you. Why? Yeah, you know go regret. Nothing gonna make me forget. Only you are no good to share. Cause a good run la bakuwa. I told you before that I wanna go far with you. Doubt in a fit mess up too. Hasta me na boo. Show na to open me my no. Oh, no go to Roma no. Go nowhere. And if I want a baby from you, give me one. No fear, fear. Tell me, okay, let us watch it.
Myself, but then
your father is violent. Olerin, Olerin, jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Olerin, you define that your mother is black dot. She's a big galanto. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. Your father is violent. Olerin, Olerin, jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. We'll be fine, mami. Your mother is black dot. She's a big galanto. Jumbo, jumbo, jumbo. I don't get so no more.
Baby,
likes it when I stay. She says she don't want me to go. She says I always make her day. Girl, would you be my lover? No. She says she really likes my style. Seems like she wants to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my lover? No. What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. Cause now you are defined. Baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover?
Yes, yes, yes.
Would you be my lover?
Yes,
yes, yes. And if you won't be my lover, let me know.
Yes, yes.
Would you be my lover? This guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover? No. I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who Jay face. All this time you there waste, she gon' make me crazy. Why would you be my lover? Magic cruise. Wanna know if you go do. I got one question for you. Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Baby, oh.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Students of South African politics, particularly after the end of apartheid and the emergence of the African National Congress, ANC, the party of the iconic Mandela, was that South Africa should not be a one-party state for generations. That means that the expectation among some sector of the political and economic class was that the ANC over time might disintegrate and that there should be very strong opposition parties to ensure the stability of South African democracy. Indeed, over time, there have been at least three defections from the ANC, but none of them have succeeded as that of Julius Malema, who in fact was expelled from the ANC and was then the youth leader of the ANC. His group, the Economic Freedom Fighters, has been a bone in the throat of the ANC in parliament. On the opposition side, the reliance has been placed on the Democratic Alliance, DA. The DA has its roots during the apartheid period, as far back as 1989. At that time, it was seen as a progressive party because it criticized the apartheid government from time to time. The support was mostly in the English element of the white population at the time. The leader of the DA, Helen Zille, was a very feisty leader, and she was the mayor of Cape Town and now the premier of Western Cape, which is the stronghold of the DA. The DA now enjoys major support from the white population and the colored population. Helen Zille realized that the perception in South Africa was that the DA was a white man's party. So she struggled to change that perception. And one of her proposals was to have the DA headed by a black South African. And in 2015, May, she handed over the leadership to Minusi Malmane, a black leader who is also a very feisty speaker. Now, when he became the leader of the DA in 2015, he adopted two strategies. One was to go after President Zuma because of the numerous corruption accusations against him, and to also go after the Gupta families, a wealthy Indian family now nationalized in South Africa. And the son of Zuma works with this family, and they have coined a phrase, state capture. The next thing he did was to go frequently to the courts to more or less arrest President Zuma and to get the court to rule against the ANC. And then the next trick was to call as often as possible for a no-confidence vote against Zuma in parliament. And the last one was the ninth, which was a secret ballot. He had assumed that because of the dispute within the ANC, a large number of MPs of the ANC would vote along with the DA, and they would oust the ANC, and there would be new election, which he believes he will win under the banner of the DA. Of course, that failed. And now last week, he has come with another strategy, which people consider going too far. He is going to submit a motion in parliament to dissolve parliament now and call for new election. You may ask, why is he doing that, and why is the DA going after that? This is to upend the strategy of the ANC. In December of this year, the ANC will select the president of the ANC, and there it is being hotly contested, and the winner of the presidency of the ANC will take the ANC to the election. Now, what the DA wants is to fight the election under the banner of Zuma. And that is the reason why he has made this proposal, which has been roundly criticized in South Africa. So in any case, it would seem that the DA has taken a bridge too far and would definitely receive a setback. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Patrick Deya, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, when the rain pours on chili peppers, it does not diminish its virility. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Azerbaijani authorities have arrested Memon Aliyev, editor-in-chief of Turin Information Agency, and sentenced him to 3 months of pretrial detention pending trial on charges of tax evasion and abuse of power. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We are deeply troubled by the August 24th arrest and three-month pretrial detention of Memon Aliyev, the prominent editor-in-chief of Azerbaijan's only remaining independent media outlet, Turin Information Agency. Other restrictive actions against Turin include freezing its bank accounts and initiating tax evasion charges against it, are also troubling. These actions by the government of Azerbaijan to curtail freedom of press and to further restrict freedom of expression," said Ms. Nauert, "are the latest in a negative trend that includes the government's May decision to block access to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and other independent media websites. The United States urges the government of Azerbaijan to immediately release Memon Aliyev and all those incarcerated for exercising their fundamental freedoms, in accordance with its international and OSCE obligations."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.